We use the term mindfulness in Buddhism to describe a specific mind state or mental activity or a class or collection of mind states that are the substance in a certain way, or the content of the investigation that we do in the process of growing toward liberation. And that's a complicated way of saying that if we want to get free, which is the center of the Buddhist and yogic traditions, the idea that we are bound or confused or ignorant of reality in some way, constricted in it, within it, that if we want liberation from that, we need to, in a way, understand it and shift our relationship to it. And so mindfulness is the quality of the mind or heart. It's most usually, I think, thought of as a quality of attention that helps us do that. It's a little bit like saying, if I were a scientist and I want to observe something, there's all the tools that I can use. There's, you know, the microscopes and the equations and the whatever it is I'm using to observe with. And then there's the quality of observation itself. There's like, oh, I look into the microscope, and there's all the tools. There's my eye, there's the lenses, there's whatever I'm using. And there's this thing where I bring my conscious attention to bear on what I'm observing. And I investigate it a little bit. And that investigation is powered by mindfulness. The word mindfulness is kind of the old British translation of the Pali word sati, and the Sanskrit word smriti, and it's the word for memory. So, and it may well be that in some aspect of the early tradition, mindfulness was part of the quality you developed by, like, learning to memorize long sections of text. You'd memorize texts and chants if you were a monastic. And that memorization was part of what trained the mind to focus, to stay with one thing in a sustained way, to focus on detail, to commit something to familiarity, but also to understand it, to really stay with it for a time. And then more abstractly, if mindfulness is what happens when we notice something, like I could say, you know, oh, I'm mindful of the sound of the lawnmower outside. That's kind of a casual way to say I'm aware of it. I'm conscious and aware of it. But to think abstractly about it just for a moment, we could think, like, what's actually happening when I say that that's what's going on, I'm mindful of a sound, or I'm mindful of a sensation or a feeling. We can say that there's a knowing or connecting quality in this moment. And this gets hard to describe, because what we're trying to describe, in a way, is the difference between when you're aware of something and you know it, or you're aware of something and you don't know it, in a way. And that sounds a little strange. Like, how could you be aware of something and not know it? And so here's the ancient metaphor. It's a little bit like when you're in a dream, but you're not lucid in it. Like, the dream is going on. You are aware, like, your mind is doing something. But you're not awake to what's happening. There's awareness, but not consciousness. Yeah? You're unconscious, technically. But your mind is aware. The dream is things are firing in your senses. That's the extreme example. The milder example is daydreaming, or your mind is wandering, right? So you're wherever you are, you're sitting in meditation, or you're driving, or you're standing in line somewhere, or you're talking to someone you're not that interested in, or whatever's going on. And you're aware of what's happening. Like, you know where you are talking to this person, or that you're in line, or that you're driving. But actually, your attention, the part in you that's actually giving energy to something, is engaged elsewhere. I'm engaged in the fantasy. I'm engaged with some worry or some other part of my story. I'm planning what I'll say to someone later on. And one of the things that characterizes those kind of states is that the thing that I'm doing, the fantasy, let's say, or the worry, like the dream when you're asleep, it's happening, and I could tell you what it is, but I'm not consciously aware of it. And what that means, in a way, is that I don't have full control over it. I don't have full volitional control. This is an interesting proposition because it essentially means that if you're really aware of something, you can do something in relation to it. If you're really aware of where your attention is, you could choose to change it. But what is anxiety other than like the mind spinning with thought and feeling in a way that I could tell you it's happening, but somehow I don't have a grip on. I can't actually just decide to make it different. And so part of what we'll talk about with mindfulness is that there's both the awareness of what's happening, and there's a kind of witness presence in relationship to it. And the thing that that witness presence can do is not change the thing it's observing necessarily. Bless you. Like I can't necessarily make anxious thoughts stop. If you could consciously do that, you just would. That would be easy. You would just be like, may they stop and not return all day. And suddenly, like, bing, they're gone. Right? That would be amazing. That's not how it works. We seem to have to sort of interrupt them and stop them many, 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 many times. And they come back. So they're clearly out of my control in some way. The thing that I have control over is where I place my attention. So this seems to be one of the main things that we can get our hands on in terms of the mind or the attentional qualities. And we can pull our attention towards something. So I can notice that my attention is drawn to the sound of the lawnmower or to anxious thoughts or whatever. It's pulling me, and I can say, ignore those for now and stay with the breath. I bring my attention back, and it takes a little force of will at first to stay with this thing. And so we are using this word that means memory for this quality. What's happening when you're remembering something? It's that it's appearing to your attention. Something that happened gets brighter when you attend to it. And so like, oh, I'm remembering this thing that you said yesterday. Like out of the fog of the past, this specific thing is emerging. It's coalescing in my awareness. Oh, I'm remembering that. It's coming back to me. So then the instructions toward mindfulness from the earliest layer of the Buddhist tradition say that this is a quality that one brings volitionally into the field. The text on mindfulness says in the beginning, it's an instructional text, it tells you all these things to pay attention to. But it starts with, you know, in a place that's conducive for practice, sit comfortably and upright, and bring up this quality of mindfulness, or bring mindfulness to the forefront. Bring it to the front. And that implies, in a way, that it's a quality that's always present somewhat. Like, notice for a moment now that you know where you are. So notice that you know that you're in namaste, in the yoga studio, that you've come to satsang, to the meditation group. Notice that you know that it's Tuesday evening. And I'm projecting a little on you. You may have forgotten, but I assume you know these things. And then notice that you know what posture your body's in. You know whether you're sitting up or lying down and how your limbs are arranged. Notice that you know what you're wearing. You could say, oh yeah, I'm wearing this shirt or that shirt, this pants. You know what temperature it is in here. We could go through this long list of things that you already know, you're already aware of, but you may not be bringing your conscious, deliberate attention to. But if you brought deliberate attention to them, the quality of that thing would shine out from the general background hum, and it would stand out. But, oh, I know that I'm sitting up in this cross-legged position that I like to sit in, and at the moment my hand is on my leg in this way, my arm is like this. What happens when I bring mindfulness to something is that its qualities emerge from the background hum. Even though they were always there in a way available to be seen, and in many cases they were already present in the sense field. But they kind of bloom in an interesting way when I bring my attention to them. So let's keep doing a couple experiments. Bring your attention to a piece of clothing that you're wearing, say. Just choose one. And you already know that you're wearing it, but bring your attention to it and see what emerges or blossoms for you about it. You might really see the image of it, its color, its lines, its shapes, its patterns. You might really sense how it feels on your body. What are the exact sensations that are present with this piece of clothing? And hang out with it for a few moments and just notice how much detail you can actually sense about this just by bringing your attention to it, even though it was there all along. So any responses, first of all, like, what's that like? What happens when you bring your attention to this thing that was already there, but then you focus on it a little? What do you notice happens in that moment?
Doing this sweater, and then I was just—it's like the whole history of the sweater, and
yeah.
You know, I washed it, and then it shrunk up, and then it got loose, and then it's like this whole,
yeah,
you know, ridiculous.
Well, perhaps or not, but it's amazing that, like, you know that history, right? So you concentrate on the sweater, and then the history of the sweater, your relationship history, appears. You know that that's the case. Like, it's not like you've forgotten,
right,
the history. But that activity of, like, you just shine the light, you know, you turn the lens toward that thing, and it shows, and suddenly, like, boom, there it is.
Right?
Right? And just out of curiosity, what's the quality that seems ridiculous about that? Because I get it when you say that. I'm like, yeah, right?
Just that it has a story. That it,
yeah.
The story of seems so mundane, not really that interesting or important. But since you said to do it, then you know it.
Yep.
Just popped up. You know.
And if you stayed with it, how far did you think the story would go?
Well, that actually what So what came up for me is that, you know, it gets creative for me to do stuff like that. You can just spin out.
Yeah. Right.
It's like spinning out on the lines and just thinking, you know, I really do like this pattern. And, you know, but then I feel like, well, who cares? You know, I mean, I don't have too much caring about that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, well.
Right, so it's relatively neutral, which makes it a good first object of investigation, because you're not getting super caught in, like, you know, oh God, it's the sweater that my friend gave me before we had this big rupture, and then we kind of broke up, and then the sweater kind of, oh wait, the sweater sort of reminds me of my mom, ah, you know, like, it could be a really charged item, but instead it's neutral, and I think one of the things that seems ridiculous sometimes about that sort of thing is, like, I tune into something and then my mind can just go forever with it. It's partly that the associative network is infinite. And so you can follow any pathway to anything, you know. But also that the amount of information present in any one thing is also infinite, you know. So, you know, your mind could go, the sweater, it's comfortable, it's a little loose. Oh, well, it loosened, but it had been tight because I washed it because it shrank. And it could go further with that investigation. You know, it could be like, well, you know, the sweater's 20% rayon and the other percent, you know, and rayon and wool, they always shrink. They shrink kind of weirdly, you know. But you know, the part that was wool, like, well, that was sheep. And actually, you know, where did I get this? I got this in Scotland. This is Scottish sheep. Scotland has sheep. And they, you know, like, however far you go with that. At a certain point, you can notice that your mind shifts from direct contact with the thing to the kind of associative network chain. We call this proliferation of thought. And what tends to happen in that is that we go unconscious again. So we lose what I'm lately been calling, like, somatic presence. And we go into a kind of mental field. And so mindfulness, in a sense, is the quality of coming into contact with the object that shows its nature. And then we want to watch out for a moment when the description of the thing, rather than being a description of something that's within my somatic consciousness, the description of the thing becomes the primary thing I'm doing. And then I'm no longer somatically present, but I'm mentally present. And that takes me further away. And so we call it not present. I'm talking about daydreaming about sheep and stuff. You know, haggis. So, so mindfulness is that initial quality. Right? And in a way, there's nothing ridiculous about it other than sort of the nature of our minds to go so quickly, so far afield. Other thoughts? What's anything else that you notice happen when you brought your attention to a simple thing?
I was also thinking about my sweater, and as I started to notice the way that it felt against my skin, I found I got goosebumps. Mm. Not because I was cold, but just because I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the way fabrics feel on me unless they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And when I did feel it, it's like my skin, I don't know, heightened.
So yeah, responded in some way. Right. And the feel of the fabric on your skin is pleasurable?
Yeah. This is a very soft, comfy sweater. That's why I wear it here every single
totally,
day.
Right? Excellent. Excellent. This is a very interesting piece around mindfulness that, you know, we very often, we're trained, all subconsciously, but we're trained, and our nervous systems are trained to mostly only notice things when they're unpleasant, you know? So, like, you wear it all the time, maybe you you know that it's comfortable, but you don't, in an embodied way, connect with the sensation, you know,
right.
As primary.
Comfort doesn't, it's not a feeling. It's just a, like,
yeah.
You're right, I don't notice states of comfort until they go away.
Right, right. And the nervous system is built this way, you know. It's you stay alive more reliably if you notice things that when they go wrong, right? Because that's your threat system turning on. Things that feel good, your biology kind of interprets as like, well, you know, continuing to be alive is feels predictable at the moment. No indications otherwise. Therefore, I don't have to attend to this sensation. I've just been reading about the neurology of mind states in and discussions of what is being called right now the default mode network, and this is an area of the brain that is responsible in a sense for organizing the information that comes in through our senses into the most predictable arrangement possible. In other words, this very thing in us that wants to stay safe and stay alive, wants to detect threat, when it is in the presence of that which is non-threatening and which also means familiar. Like, if this was a brand new sweater to you, it was somebody else's sweater you were borrowing, and you had never felt this exact sensation before, you'd probably notice it. Partly because the brain is going, is this a safe sensation or not? First I have to assess, and to assess it I have to notice it. You know, and then you might be like, oh yeah, great sweater, super comfy. And your friend says, like, oh, you can borrow it for as long as you want. And probably three or four times later after you wear it, you stop noticing how comfy it is. It becomes the norm. The default mode network scoops up that bit of information and says, I don't really need to pay attention to that. I can conserve energy and only pay attention to that which I need to pay attention to. And so this is really good for having a functional map of the world and for, you know, existing within it. But part of what it does is it puts us to sleep in the presence of normalness. So if you know this room, or you're familiar with the studio, or you're familiar with this part of Berkeley, there's some way that you don't have to track that information each time you enter it. You know, I think this is partly, this has ramifications on every level. You know, when I meet someone that I know, there's some way that I don't have to assess them for safety, for threat. I don't have to wonder, you know, why they're here or who they are or all of these things. My mind just goes, ah, it's Orly. Boom, done. I know you, you know. And in a certain way, it almost feels like it's the opposite of what we want to happen with friendship, which is like, oh, hi, it's good to see you. There's that. But I think that's extra. The first thing that happens is like, especially when there's familiarity, like if I see you every week, the brain doesn't have to log that this is different. And therefore it becomes part of the norm. And we do this with everything. If you took in the newness of every moment, it would be a flood of information. And this is actually one of the things that happens in deep meditative states. And other heightened states, is that the default mode network quiets down. In really, really concentrated or experienced meditators, they'll notice on EKGs or, you know, fMRIs, brain scans, that this part of the brain, the default mode network, quiets down. It doesn't do as much. And then meditators will report, oh, I was in this sublime state where everything seemed as if brand new, or even the ordinary floor was so dynamic, or you know, it shone with kind of presence. And the thing that each of you reported in a certain way is that the object, a familiar item of clothing, it shone out from the background hum with a kind of, here's a very yoga word, luminosity. It showed an aspect of itself. And sometimes that aspect is so distinct that we really have a response. Right? Your skin like responded to just tuning into the softness of the sweater and then like goosebumps. We wake up to an experience when we bring our attention to it. And then it blossoms in a certain way. It shows itself. This is the basic mechanism of deepening in practice, is to bring your attention to things, to useful things, and to be with them until they really show themselves. This happens in a whole bunch of ways. One way that it happens is when we're with something in a sustained way, like you stay with the breath, and it's called mindfulness of breathing. Right? You do mindfulness of breathing, you bring your attention to this thing that's always there. Right? You're always breathing. Most of the time you don't notice it. You mostly notice it when you're out of the norm. So like when you run hard or you get scared or you have the hiccups or something happens to disrupt the usual breath pattern. That's immediately noticeable. Right? Especially if breath gets constricted. That's one of the biggest alarm signals we have in the body. So breath starts to not work the usual way, all of your attention will immediately go to that. That's at the top of the list as far as survival. You can go without food and water for a while, not with breath. So, you notice when you're hungry, but you can kind of ignore it for a while. You can't ignore not breathing, right, for more than a couple seconds. So you take something like breath that's always there, but it's on autopilot, and you turn your attention to it. You become mindful of it. And when the quality of mindfulness, you remember it, it shows up to you like a memory, not meaning in the past, but like when you become present with something. And first what it does is it kind of blossoms its particular qualities. And you notice things like, oh, my breath is a little constricted today, or oh, that was a full breath, or oh, my breath is kind of rough or shallow or deep, or breath feels good, breath doesn't feel good. You notice those kind of basic qualities of it. But then what starts to happen is if you can stay with it for longer and not spin off into mental distraction, thought storms, then what happens is it starts to show other qualities. And some of the other qualities start to be pleasurable. Oh, the breath feels good. And that there's the caveat to that is that it doesn't feel good for folks for whom the breath has been endangered or constricted. So like if you've had asthma or a drowning experience or any of that, you're not going to want to meditate on the breath. Right? Because the breath is going to show those aspects to you. The breath is going to say, hey, this has been hard, and you're going to have to process that. But if the breath hasn't been wounded in that way, you meditate on the breath, things get quiet, the breath shows its qualities. And then if you stay, it starts to show other qualities. And those qualities are qualities that start to interweave with the qualities that are present when the attention itself is stable. So one of the interesting things that happens in the mind with mindfulness is that when mindfulness doesn't flicker for a while, meaning doesn't, do what it usually does, where like I'm conscious of the floor, but then my mind wanders for a while. And I'm conscious of a feeling, and then my mind wanders for a while. And I feel a few breaths, and then my mind wanders for a while. When mindfulness sustains, where I'm conscious of something and I keep being conscious of it for a while, or even I'm conscious of changing things, but there's not a lapse in that awareness. There's not a lapse in mindfulness. That quality of being focused itself is actually pleasurable, and it starts to show its qualities as well. So then sustained attention feels good. And stabilizing, nourishing, joyful, calming, all of these qualities start to emerge as we stay with something for a while. So then mindfulness is synonymous in a way with presence. And I'm calling it somatic presence because the main distinction we make is between sensory activity that's coming through the bodily senses and sensory activity that's coming through the mental factors, the thinking factors. And you can be present with a train of thought. You can totally be present with a fantasy or a distraction. If you're present with it, it's not a distraction anymore. It's a thought that you're thinking in a kind of active way. But let's do a second experiment. So we did that experiment with like a piece of clothing that's just an ordinary thing here. Now let's do one that's still a somatic one, but is more subtle or internal. And I'll invite you to notice your mood. So like the emotional tone that's coloring your state right now. You can notice it in a couple of ways. First, notice if it's just generally on the pleasant or unpleasant side of the spectrum. Pleasant means that you'd be pleased if it continued or even deepened in that direction. Unpleasant means that you would prefer it to change in the direction of the pleasant. And then you might discern even more distinctly the subtler qualities of it. What kind of emotional tone are you in or manifesting right now? And really try to give it a word or two in your mind, just as a way to identify it. So again, what happens as you do so? Or what did you notice as you do that?
I think that it's a pleasure to be able to sit with 100% alert, paying attention. It's a pleasure.
Being able to sit with 100% alert, paying attention is itself a pleasure, mm-hmm. just that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then is that pleasure or that quality of attention, does that feel like it's the primary emotional tone that's present? Or is there another kind of mood or emotional tone that quality of alertness contacts?
Peace.
Ease. Yeah. And so then when you notice ease, what happens?
I'm relaxed.
You're relaxed, yeah. And does the relaxation deepen as you notice the ease and kind of hang out with it? Do you get a little shift?
I think it's been carried from the sitting meditation.
Uh-huh, yes.
Sitting still physically and not moving is a pleasure.
Yeah.
Mentally.
Yes. Right. So you bring your attention to your mood and you notice both the pleasurable quality of this kind of attention you're in right now and the ease that's present, carrying over, you know, from the sitting meditation. Mm-hmm. And before we did the little experiment just now of noticing them, those qualities were still there. There was some focus in your mind. There was some ease in your state. Do you have a sense of what shifted when you brought your attention to them? Like, did you... like, did you notice more about them? Or did they feel different when you directed your attention to them differently than, like, resting in them but directing your attention to what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like that. Yeah?
There was attention to...
Yeah.
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 There was attention.
Yeah.
It shifted.
Yeah.
It takes some effort.
Yeah.
Because it's internal. It's internal.
Yeah.
So I feel it is being outward focus.
Yes. Yes.
Then shifting.
Yeah. Absolutely. It does take a little effort. And totally. Totally. Other thoughts? You notice? Yeah. Hmm? Yeah.
I just had to, like, own what I was feeling, which I was, like, trying to be like, no, you're fine. And I was like, okay, you just have to call it sad and move on.
Just
name the fucking thing.
Totally.
But that's, like, so there is just an element of, you know, when you have to name it. I think that's always a different moment than just having it or being it.
Yeah. And something happens when you name it. Like, but even before you named it, there's this little, like, thing that goes on. Like, you know it's there.
You know the whole day it's there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to name it, or you don't. But then you're not doing whatever the work that you want to be doing.
Right, right. It's interesting. Like, it's not like you knew you were... It's not like you would ever be, you know, forced to even say it to someone else. It's really just internal to you. I so know that feeling where, like, I know that I'm in a given mood, but I don't really even want to look at it.
Right.
I kind of just want it to sort of...
It would be great if it went away.
Go.
If it figured itself out.
If it figured itself out, thank you very much.
That would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And they sometimes do, right? That's...
And I could live a life where I just wait for them all to figure themselves out, but it's not...
Which, so this is really interesting, right? You you can recognize, now this is a hint as to why this is actually an addiction model, right? You can recognize that it would actually be a reasonable choice in an interesting way to kind of just stay checked out.
Oh, for sure.
For sure, right? It's like, yeah, I just, you know, la, 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 la.
That would be fantastic.
Right, right.
In many ways.
If it only worked.
It would be
fantastic. Right. Right. So instead of that, there's this amazing process that happens where mindfulness isn't just this quality of mind that's like, see what it is, but it actually has to push through a layer of resistance. You know, and I know that layer so well. It's like, oh, yeah, just... You know, I just have to admit it.
It's really my best way, resistance.
It's great. It's great. So well practiced.
Wrong layer.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
So one of the really interesting places in practice is exactly this, especially the ways that, as you're saying, you know how to do it otherwise. You know that it's helpful to do otherwise. And you said, like, and you want to do otherwise. This is that's not the life you want to live either, right? And so, you know, I've practiced with this for a long time, in the sense of, like, waking up or becoming mindful of something, has this whole aspect in it of being willing to wake up and be present with something. And you know the feeling where, like, and of course Facebook is a great example of this, but the feeling of where, like, I'm doing something, I notice that I'm doing it, so mindfulness kicks in. I can feel that it's unpleasant, and so mindfulness of the mood or the tone of it kicks in. And then I know what I should do. Like, I totally know how to, like, turn away, right? Stop scrolling. I've seen enough here. Move on. Move along, people. But there's a gap of time between the moment when I know that is true and when I actually do it, you know? And that's one of the qualities that hinders us so terribly in maturing, in liberation. And it's really the, if it sustains, that's really the addictive mindset. It's like, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but somehow I can't help it. And what does that mean? You know? Does that really mean I'm not in control of my actions? Is there some way that the quality of volition, of just like being in charge of what I do, that's also a quality, like mindfulness, that could be weak or strong at any given moment. When my mind is super wandering, mindfulness is not there, volition is also not there. That's why they're so tied together. There's a way that becoming mindful of something is a prerequisite to having volition over it. So I have this practice that I do on the computer where if I'm scrolling endlessly or I'm on something or I'm reading some website that I don't need to be reading, whatever it is, my left hand knows the key click that is, you know, Command W, which is to close the tab, just like blow it away. And what I'll do is the state of getting lost in it is so thick, but my hand knows that gesture. And so what I do is I just try to stay open to the impulse actually reaching my hand, my left hand. And when the impulse reaches my left hand, I don't restrain it. And I just, like, before I think about it, just zap it, and it goes. And then there's this relief, like, oh, I wake up from this little nightmare. So you're describing this beautiful thing. You know, it's a powerful moment in practice. I didn't want to admit it, and I just admit it. Then the next step, right? What happened to the quality of the mood once you said it, once you said the word?
Then I located it in my body where I was feeling it. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to breathe into that space.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't exactly what happened to the quality of the feeling, but is where the actions I took.
Yeah.
In light of it.
Yeah. Right. So you have some, you're not a beginner in the realm of mindfulness and processing feeling, of course. So you know that pathway of actions is useful,
yeah.
Right? Come to it in the body, contact it. Yeah. And that very process, like even before you took the effort to say, like, breathe into it, contacting into the body is this way. We can think of it in a kind of top-down way, like I went looking for it in the body. Oh, there it is. It's in my belly or my heart or whatever.
Right.
But we could also think of it as I opened myself to the state, sadness. And in opening myself to it, the sensation where it was centered emerged. And almost like it came forward. And I was mindfulness was available, and the sensation came forward. And one of the beauties of thinking about it that way is you can take the I am doing it aspect out. And you can say, in a way, The only thing you do is it's hard even to say what we do, because you partly did it because I suggested it, right? So it can happen on its own.
Well, I opened myself up to the idea of thinking about it.
You opened. Yeah, yeah. And so I think in a way, that is almost the definition of mindfulness, which is like, I open myself in a given direction. There's a kind of directionality too. It's like I open myself to my mood. If the suggestion had been, you know, open yourself to, you know, the news right now, you'd be like, ah, I don't want to. But that would be a very different thing to open yourself to, you know. Which means, of course, that what you open yourself to is one of the most important choices you make, speaking of the news or Facebook or things to abstain from. It's partly why in the therapeutic modalities that I work in, like organic intelligence, one of the very first things we'll ask people is not, oh, how are you doing? Because that's likely to get a response of, like, what's wrong? But also not, like, oh, tell me about the trauma that happened that brought you in to get, you know, therapeutic work. Because that's also going to draw the attention only in that direction. But instead, you know, I'm going to say something like, oh, what was the time recently when you really felt like yourself, or you really felt at ease? Because the suggestion points our attention, our mindfulness quality, towards something. I say, oh, ease. I was doing this thing lately, and it was just lovely, you know. And when we do that, the loveliness or the ease, the sensation of the sweater, the thought of, you know, this pleasurable thing I was doing, whatever, it emerges and is met by awareness. So we kind of shine the light of awareness in a direction, and then whatever it shines on blossoms to meet it. And then that experience enriches. It gets richer with detail. We see it more clearly. Please.
Yeah, so I had like a basic feeling. I thought, oh, I feel good, I'm pretty relaxed. Mm-hmm. But then the rest of it was like all commentary. Just quickly, like,
right.
Just, oh, I'm doing a new thing, I'm so proud of myself, what a good girl am I.
Totally, totally.
It's like, right. Oh, okay, well, that kind of ruins it, you know, I don't. Not feeling right. That good and relaxed anymore now.
Wait, I was feeling so good. Now I'm not so sure. So sorry. Welcome to the mind. Indeed. Right. It's amazing that happens. And so then, in a way, what mindfulness wants to do is trace back in a way. Like, okay, for the commentary is fine. But you come back to like, oh, wait, I was feeling just basically good. And then the investigation that mindfulness can do is to say, like, okay, connect with that first felt sense, feeling good. And then, like, what is that? What does that feel like? And it's very, you know, we're such, like, we're pleasure-oriented mammals. That is the thing we do. But given that, it's remarkable how poor we can be at actually staying present with or describing or being curious about pleasure. In other words, here's you feel basically good, especially we like high-end pleasure, you know, super intense. But the ordinary, simpler pleasures, I think some part of our mind, I think this is part of the default mode network, it's not threatening, therefore we numb out to it. And in this remarkable bit of fantasy, wishful thinking, we also convince ourselves that those states of relative ease are actually the norm. We're like, this is the baseline, this is how we should be. And then if I'm upset, that's worse, and that needs to be fixed. And if I'm having a peak experience, then that's awesome. But it basically should be steady at this like kind of baseline norm. And again, I think this is biological. I think that that's a state that is not guaranteed in nature, but it's the state where we feel safe and at ease. And when we do that, all this other busy stuff drops away. I'm just here. That mild but palpable ease is basically the best of the doorways to meditation. You can contact that, and then here's the rub, stay in contact with that without proliferating into commentary. Then the mind starts to do some really nice stuff, really settles down, because you're not worried. As soon as you're not worried, I'm tempted to say this is not very profound, as soon as you're not worried, you're not worried. Like, boom, there's nothing else to do, really. So we're just sitting here. So nice. So then mindfulness connects with goodness and good feeling. And what it could train to do then, the main training would be something like discern more detail in that state. What is this kind of basically feeling good thing actually feel like? And you can start to tease out things like, okay, well, what does it feel like in the breath? Not that much constriction, no pain. There's a kind of pleasurable flow. What's it feel like in the musculature? Like, oh, there's a sort of soft hum through my limbs, not too intense. Like, you could start to define it in all these ways as a method for keeping the attention engaged with it for long enough that the commentarial tendency settles down. But that's the main thing that we fight against, you know, is the tendency to proliferate in the mental realm away from the basic somatic information. So if this is what we're doing so much of the time, then at some point in mindfulness practice, we need to actually attend to that habit. Right? So like one part of mindfulness practice is the thing is cultivating the thing that we want to do, which is to come into presence with ourselves, with the sensations we're having, with our mood, with our all the sensory information that's here. The other thing to do is to diminish, this is really the limb of wise effort, is to diminish the tendency to do things that are other than that are not useful. And one of the main things that's not useful is to spin away in thought, especially charged thought. And by charged, I mean thought that's substantially pleasant or unpleasant in a way that's particularly, this happens when like the present moment somatic state is somewhere in a given range. It's pleasant or unpleasant within a sort of mid-range. And the mind goes into stories, memories, planning, fantasy, fear, anxiety, enthusiasm, creativity. Pleasant or unpleasant, but what it tends to do is it goes toward object, situation, states that are more charged than that normal realm. So like, I'm basically here, I feel okay, but I'm going to worry about something that could be really going wrong. So more charged in the negative direction. While I'm sitting here, things are basically okay, I feel pretty good, and I'm going to start like, I'm going to feel so sort of at ease that I suddenly like get all creative and I start like writing a poem or thinking about this thing I want to do. And it feels really pleasurable. So the mind leaps toward the more extreme charges. It's actually really relatively hard to stay with neutral charge or a kind of a milder range of charge. So part of mindfulness practice is to learn to stay with the ordinary states in a more sustained way. Because so often what's happening when we get distracted is the mind is running through patterns of content that so often it's a little bit negative. not always, but so often it's a little bit negative, and that it has the quality of some one of the self-protective flavors. So I'm in my sympathetic nervous system. I'm activated in some way. So I'm getting distracted by planning the future. And this is a form of fear, basically. Like, things aren't going to go well, therefore I need to get organized in relation to them. There's some energy of self-protective activation happening. And that's the activation that's fueling that flight of fantasy or planning or worry. So I have to recognize that that's that. I don't need to fear that in this very moment and come back to, you know, what's actually here. Yeah.
How does this whole concept work for people, or maybe I would assume that someone who has dealt with a lot of trauma or is still dealing with a lot of trauma, mm-hmm. In just everyday normal life, that the state you're describing would not be their baseline?
Right.
How does that work for those individuals?
Yeah. For folks whose normal baseline is threat, is the feeling of being threatened in some way, unsafety. Mindfulness as a primary practice is difficult, because if you bring your attention, if you come into somatic presence, you come into any kind of presence, it's likely that the material you come into contact with will be colored by trauma. So, you know, if I've been systematically oppressed for any aspect of my character, whatever it is, whether that's, you know, racial or sexual or economic or you know, cultural or whatever factor, I exist in a way that is, say, oppressed by the mainstream, by aspect of the mainstream. And so I come into lots of different kinds of spaces. I come into a yoga studio. I go to, you know, a place where I'm not the centered identity. Therefore, I can perceive some subtle threat. You know, there's totally folks who don't feel safe in the, you know, the modern, expensive, white-centric, middle-class-centric, you know, cisgendered, female-centric yoga studio like we're in. And so what would it mean to come into mindfulness in such a situation? I would become more mindful of the feeling of being not safe. Right? I would have to, right? If I'm going to become more somatically present, whatever qualities are present in what I'm paying attention to are going to emerge. And so I'm going to be more mindful of that pain. This is partly why mindfulness as a practice in relation to groups of folks who are systematically oppressed or groups of folks who are wounded in a trauma kind of way, in any flavor, are served well by situations where as much safety as possible is created. So, like, if one of the primary oppressions I feel, let's say, is racial, like we've been talking about for the last few weeks, it'll be useful for me to perhaps practice in a racially segregated setting, like within an affinity group. You know, if I identify as a person of color, to practice within an all POC group, within an institution or a building or an environment that centers the POC experience, that is awake to it, that doesn't dismiss it, that doesn't perpetuate that oppression, then I may be able to, when mindfulness arrives, connect with what feels good about being there, and then be able to, you know, come out of just the sympathetic nervous system. So I'm going to need other qualities to be in place. If when mindfulness is brought to the fore, if I can only find pain, it's going to be very difficult to develop that practice, because I'll have to have force of will really to engage in it. Like, the body just doesn't want that. It's better to be checked out if that's my experience. If every time I become somatically present, I encounter pain, I'm not going to do it. You know, I'm going to choose intoxication or distraction, as most of the world does, I think. So most of this culture in many ways does. So mindfulness is radical in that it insists that presence is more healthy than non-presence. It insists that being with your experience is the way, rather than turning away from it. But then we have to recognize that there's all sorts of people that need more basic support before that experience can really develop toward the positive. Part of this opens into, I'll talk about this in coming weeks, ways that the secular mindfulness movement nowadays has, or just, you know, mindfulness as a sort of American cultural trope now, has arrived as a way to say that this quality of, you know, being present with things as you're doing them or as they're happening is kind of good for everybody all the time. It's so good you can name magazines after it, and you know, there's so much you can do that's like mindful this, mindful that. But that usage ignores or sidelines the thing that you're referring to. You know, it sidelines trauma. It basically says, it's basically a privileged position to say, like, oh, just do this nice thing. You know, pay attention to the warm water running over your hands as you're washing the dishes, and that brings you into presence and you're less stressed, et cetera, et cetera.
You wash dishes 14 hours a night.
Seriously, that's not what you want to do. It doesn't feel so good. In an interesting way, one could say, oh, if the person who washes dishes 14 hours a night did that practice of, like, almost like bracketing off the suffering in the situation and tuning their attention fully just to the sensation of the water, it would be possible to tune into its pleasure. But to do so would be, to encourage them to do so would be a subtle kind of violence, because it would suggest that they could somehow, you know, fix their situation just through an act of the mind, rather than through, of course, you know, lobbying for better working conditions or being paid better, all of that. So we'll continue in that direction, unpacking that weave. Sweet.
I'm sorry if I'm interrupting. My ride's coming.
No worries. No, this is our moment. Welcome to you. Welcome to new folks. We'll continue for a while now from this seed of talking about mindfulness. We'll go on into kind of breaking out some of that detail as this most foundational of Buddhist practices. So thank you for being here.